Have you ever had a fantastic experience with healthcare? What about a not so great one? Well, here at the Alinea Life Podcast, we're going to talk about it. The Alinea Life Podcast, a production of the Alinea Collective, exists to be a public resource to you, the listener, who at some point or another has been a patient of this crazy thing we call the healthcare system. Co-hosts and doctors of physical therapy, William Mills and Joey Rosie, interview experts in the fields of physical rehabilitation, fitness, and medicine, as well as the athletes and patients, on their experiences with the good, the bad, and the ugly of healthcare. I was happy with that one.
The topics discussed in this podcast should not be considered medical advice or a means of diagnosis. If you're in need of medical attention or advice, seek a licensed healthcare professional. The conversations in the Alinea Life Podcast are intended for adult audiences only. And though we keep most topics professional, there is occasional strong language.
Well, anyway, I'm staying at my friend David's. David is... I'm William Mills. P.S., by the way, I am a doctor of physical therapy, and I'm on the Musings Tour 2018 with the Alinea Life Podcast. And I will be in Winchester, Virginia tomorrow. Tonight, I'm in Lexington, Virginia, visiting my friend David Kemp, a.k.a. DK, a.k.a. Deeks. So I might refer to him in the capacity of all three of those. But DK is a registered nurse and a BSN, and he is currently about to start his schooling to become a nurse practitioner.
That's correct.
And when does that start?
Middle of August, beginning of September.
Okay. Middle of August, beginning of September.
There's a bunch of onboarding stuff I have to do starting as early as July. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess give a little intro about yourself. Let's say medical professional background as well as fitness and how those two worlds have merged slash collided for you.
Sure. Let's see. So, first of all, I guess I started working out, you know, like everybody else did, probably like in high school and whatnot, not really knowing what I was doing. Played soccer and eventually just kind of taking my training more seriously to get better for soccer. I stumbled into CrossFit.
And what year was that?
That was in 2011.
Okay, so you're an OG.
July of 2011, right around the time of the 11 CrossFit games.
What kind of shoes did you have at this time for CrossFit?
Oh, man. I had some Asics.
So this was pre Nano?
No, it wasn't. I think the Nano 1s were already out, and I had just gotten into, when I got into CrossFit, one of the guys, the OG coaches there, Greg, he was like,
shout out to Greg Liam.
Pointed me in the direction of the New Balance Minimus. So that my first shoe for about 3 or 4 months, and then I transitioned into the Nano 2s.
So you never had Vibrams?
Well, I mean, the Minimus, the New Balance Minimus did have the Vibram sole, but no, I never got into the toe shoe.
You never had the toe shoes?
I heard about the shoe funk and the foot funk and all that, so I stayed away.
Gotcha.
Not hating that. That's fine.
So that's how you got into CrossFit?
Yeah, got into CrossFit because I wanted to be better at soccer. And then got Clint involved in my soccer team and knew him from CrossFit. And then one day I kicked a long ball to Clint, and my legs were sore. And I was like, man, this is really going to affect my Fran time tomorrow. So I said, forget this soccer nonsense, and kind of just gravitated towards CrossFit being my hobby.
Okay. And you haven't looked back since?
Haven't looked back since. Competed mediocrely in super scaled divisions all across the land.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your fitness origins.
Right.
What about where did your nursing?
Oh yeah.
Kind of.
That was the main crux of the question. Let's see. January of 2011, so about 6 months before I started CrossFit, I started nursing school. So I was already working out, but nursing school was like my complete and total utter focus.
Okay.
And that first semester was pretty brutal. I don't know why I was really drawn to nursing. I've always been very much a people person and enjoyed helping others and working with people. I had done odd jobs. I had done like retail, working at Best Buy, but...
And you also slap at the boss.
I did slap at the boss. I played in a wedding band for the entirety of my nursing school career.
So that was your side gig?
That was my only source of income during nursing school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what had... So the draw to help people, why did you choose being a nurse? Like, what made you choose that specific scope?
That's kind of a hard question to answer. Well, no, it's not.
Did it just kind of happen?
I just kind of fell into it because I had been working in a radiology department in Baton Rouge.
Okay.
And I was working in the radiology department. So you would think like, oh, be a rad tech or something like that.
Yeah.
That's
a really cool abbreve.
Rad tech?
Rad tech.
So rad. But no, you would think like maybe, yeah, going into radiology or something like that, and like x-ray tech would have been the go-to. But I don't know. I worked with a nurse that was there in the CT department all the time, and he seemed like he had a cool job, and he was telling me about working in the ER and the ICU and how much, quote, fun it was to do all that. And I never saw any of the rad techs doing anything that was fun. So he said you got like an adrenaline rush. So I was always kind of drawn to that, being, I guess, a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. You get that in training with CrossFit. You get that in, lifting, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, all that. There's definitely adrenaline there. So I feel that sometimes when I'm working in the ICU.
And how long have you been working in the ICU?
I've been working in the ICU for, oh man, like almost, 4 years now. Yeah, 4 years. I started in July of 2014, and we're coming up on July of 2018 now. But I've been a nurse for 5.5 years, in January of 2013.
Gotcha.
If you don't count nursing school experience.
So... What? So the adrenaline rush had initially drawn you into the ICU. What has kind of kept you there? Still the same thing, or you just learned to love it?
You know, so there's two sides to being a nurse, especially in the ICU. Sometimes you see the same story over and over, whether it's somebody that doesn't keep good care of themselves, so they're dealing with chronic issues like diabetes or kidney issues, respiratory issues, and it's just poor self-care. A lot of that can be managed with education, but a lot of that, the other part of that is like they're just not they don't care, you know. So that part can really kind of wear down on you as an individual trying to take care of people and get them healthy. But the other side of that is like sometimes they'll take care of car wreck traumas or something like that. One guy I took care of, without giving away any specific patient information, is like, you know, a tree fell on them or something. A lot of these heartbreaking trauma cases where you'll see somebody that was doing everything right, you know, they were you know, trying to work, provide for their family, and then a tree falls on them, and you're there for your 12-hour shift, and you're helping them, and, you know, over a couple of weeks, maybe even months, you'll see them slowly coming around. They were intubated before, completely paralyzed, you know, medically, mm-hmm. or because of a spinal cord injury or something like that. And then they just come around, and to see sometimes the drive to get better mm-hmm. and better, that gives you an adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
To know that your hard work is appreciated and you see the fruits of your labor. So that's cool.
Yeah. So it tends to kind of be chronic preventable illnesses versus just crazy stories
of
dramatic and traumatic incidences.
Right. I mean, and then, you know, all the stories in between. So.
Yeah. But would you categorize that as like the two main parties, I guess?
I mean, it's, you know, the two extreme ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
So, what would you say? So with this podcast, the goal of this podcast is kind of just to be like a public resource of how patients who are seeking more knowledge can have like a free resource with solid clinicians or other fitness/medical professionals to kind of self-educate. But what would you say the line of advice would be to most of the patients that you want to try to more of like a preventative, like, because most of your or a lot of your caseload is made up of people that have things that are preventable with certain lifestyle choices. Mm-hmm. What would you say? What do you think the cure to that is? Because we can't really control for like the chances of like getting struck by lightning or
right.
a tree falling on you, but there's a lot of things that are in our power to control. So what would you say the cure for that is? Or
if you ask me tomorrow, my answer might be different, but right now it's hard for me to say anything other than the patients have to care
mm-hmm.
about their own well-being. A lot of the deficit that I've been seeing right now in Roanoke, where I'm working, is, you know, just complete non-compliance in their follow-up care once they've discharged from the hospital. I mean, there's lots of readmissions and stuff coming back to us, just boomeranging, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to give a damn.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I think, you know, if somebody was to follow up and the only thing that they had to do was physical therapy, that would be like the fun part.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. Right now, the forefront of my mind, I'm thinking about diabetic noncompliance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Which can cascade down into multiple other things.
Amputations.
Yeah.
Diabetic neuropathy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, renal failure.
Yeah.
Then you're tied to a dialysis machine every 1 to 2 days.
Yeah.
So 3 times a week.
What is the average age of these kinds of patients?
Diabetic non-compliant patients tend to be, I would say on average, probably 45 to 65 years of age.
Okay.
Yeah, if they're going to be habitually non-compliant, they're not going to live to be that much
older than 65
yeah. or so, I'd say.
Yeah, my experience with home health recently on this past contract for travel physical therapy was there was a lot of in and out of the hospital, like with their different comorbidities or things going on besides their diagnosis for physical therapy or their medical diagnosis that led them to need physical therapy. A lot of the time, with their charting, like reviewing a chart before going out to do an eval, the medical diagnosis is leg weakness,
mm-hmm.
which is a fantastic medical diagnosis. It really tells me a lot. It's very specific.
Why are they? Yeah.
It takes a large amount of education to make that diagnosis. The classic patient for home health is diabetic, peripheral neuropathy, renal failure. In Lumberton, there was a ton of congestive heart failure patients.
Yes.
And more than likely a smoker for like 30 plus years or so.
Oh, forget about it. Yeah.
So the interesting thing was in that community, Lumberton, statistically, speaking with a lot of the locals, they gave me a lot of different statistics of like the county of Robeson County, and it's pretty much yearly in the bottom two counties for health in North Carolina.
That's sad.
Yeah. And, they also told me that it's the poorest county mm-hmm. in North Carolina.
Yep.
And a lot of the research that I've seen and a lot of like the anti-smoking commercials that I usually see are geared towards like pointing out the fact that a lot of smokers nowadays are from low socioeconomic statuses because they aren't well educated early on of the negative side effects of these things that can happen. So what, do you see a lot of things that are related to smoking, like chronic smoking?
Yeah. In report, a lot of times I'll get that somebody was an ex-smoker, and I'm really impressed to see that it's becoming more common to get report on a patient who's, you know, got COPD or emphysema or something, but they're an ex-smoker since 2002 or 2001. You know, without having any actual numbers or hard data, just anecdotally, it seems like, you know, there's a trend to improving, at least quitting smoking, man.
Yeah.
But then...
For X amount of time.
Yeah. I mean, 2002, that's not yesterday. That's pretty long time ago that they decided they were going to quit smoking. So good on them for that. And you can only get... better from there. It can only help you.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, once you've got like emphysema or some obstructive pulmonary disease, it's kind of
tough.
Yeah, it's an uphill battle. But you know, that's positive.
Yeah. What was the schooling like? Like, what did y'all learn about in terms of negative side effects and kind of like the overarching principles of smokers, and like what are the statistics like from a national standpoint? Did y'all go over that?
We never went over those kind of numbers. No. And me as a nursing student, I'm going to admit this, you know, if it was something that I didn't feel that was going to apply to me working with a patient at the bedside, I kind of glossed over it.
Okay.
You know, you're in nursing school to learn, and they're supposed to be presenting you all the information that they feel is going to help you to be successful as a nurse. But my number one priority in nursing school was to pass boards and take care of my patients competently.
Yeah.
Knowing those kind of numbers didn't really, at that time, it didn't really serve me.
Mm-hmm.
But serving my patients, you know, if I saw that value, I'd probably learn about it.
Yeah.
And you know, moving forward, you know, being a nurse practitioner, that information probably will be beneficial. So
yeah,
I'll probably familiarize myself with that.
You'll probably relearn it.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. There's a lot of a lot of talks in the physical therapy circles right now about how a lot of things that we learn in school are kind of a little outdated, and the quote is, it's going to be on your boards, so you need to know it.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't have any kind of like perspective on what that's like in other healthcare fields, but were there things that you encountered in nursing school that were like, the professor is specifically telling you, you're probably not going to use this, but it's on your board exam, so you're going to need to know it.
Yeah. A lot. It was a lot of, this is the way the textbook says to do it.
Uh-huh.
Without giving any specific examples, because I'm 5.5 years removed from taking my last nursing school exam.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be, hey, this is going to be on your test. This is what you need to know for test purposes. That was the phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for test purposes, what do we need to know?
Yeah.
You know, this is the range you need to know, or this is how this medication is administered. But then once you go into, you know, working at the bedside, you know, you have like off-label uses for a medication, which have been shown in research data to be therapeutic, but maybe not FDA cleared. Mm-hmm. To say that this 100% treats such and such condition.
Yeah.
So we learn about that once we're actually working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes it's do as I say, not as I do.
Right. Okay.
That happens sometimes, but that's insider information.
Yeah. Well, it seemed, well, now that I have two perspectives of nursing as well as physical therapy,
yeah,
it seems like it could be a trend across all healthcare domains.
Mm-hmm.
It's
practical knowledge versus the scholarly knowledge. But, I mean, evidence-based practice is changing all the time.
Right, because evidence changes all the time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I had to write papers when I was finishing my BSN about evidence-based practice and formulating a trial. This one was about opioid medications and assessing.
Ooh.
Oh, we're about to open a door. yeah, I did.
Tell me what you learned about those guys.
I modeled a study on pre and post opioid medication, pain medication administration.
For what?
And guidelines for whether a patient was over-sedated and, you know, if assessment tools, mainly this assessment tool called POS.
Mm-hmm.
I'm drawing a blank on what it stands for exactly, but it's an opioid-associated sedation scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is in what context? Is this in ICU?
This is, well, I mean, this assessment scale should be for any patient that you are taking care of. You assess them, basically, their alertness.
Uh-huh.
If they're awake, if they're asleep. If they're asleep, are they easy to arouse? Are they dozing off? Are they lethargic?
Yeah.
So you've got a scale. You've got I think it was S, and then you have 1, 2, and 3.
Is this like the Glasgow Coma Scale?
Glasgow Coma Scale is more specific to neurologic function.
Okay.
So
this is specifically
POS is specific for opioid associated sedation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you assess them before, you assess them 15 minutes after administration, if it's an IV medication, if it's an oral medication, 30 minutes to an hour after.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, was it like a prospective study to where like they looked at those patients in that setting and then how that affected them once they were discharged from the hospital?
No, this was just strictly acute care. assessments. Okay. So it didn't, the POS didn't really hold as much bearing, you know, 3 hours after you have given the medication. I mean, obviously, if they're unresponsive 3 hours after you give an opioid, you're probably not going to give more opioids anytime soon.
Yeah.
But,
so what were the findings? Like, what were the conclusions? Well,
what I put together was actually just a framework and a model for a study, because I was writing this paper as my capstone project for school. We weren't actually cleared to test it on a specific population.
Yeah.
So I was writing that. I would be interested to do that study and see what we saw, but see what we found. But yeah, I was not fortunate enough to carry it out with patients. I mean, I guess I could.
Yeah.
On my own, with my own data.
Just get a research study going.
Yeah.
So I've heard one of the contributing factors to the opioid epidemic, obviously, as a physical therapist, it's a very interesting topic to me because of the role that physical therapy can play in the opioid epidemic. One stat that I've heard is a lot of hospitals historically have been concerned with ratings, like patient ratings upon discharge.
Patient satisfaction scores.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the...
HCAPs, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the stats or one of the questions that plays a role in that is how your pain was regulated. The thing that I find pretty much across the board is anytime I'm asking a patient their pain scale and using like the numeric...
Zero to ten.
Like, I always say zero being no pain, ten being you need to go to the hospital right now because you're about to die. People just drop eights like it's nothing. And it's like, oh, so you're...
sitting there in a chair saying, oh, it's about an eight.
Yeah, you're like one away from me needing to rush you to the hospital right now. So it's like this ongoing... and not to say their pain isn't real to them, but to say that like all of those factors can be summed up into one number, and then that be something that a lot of hospitals take into large account on upon discharge, but there's always this need for like further education to the patient as to what we're actually looking for with that number. How do you think that is played into this larger problem?
Let's see. So when I was in nursing school, we were always taught pain is what the patient says it is, and I still agree with that.
Yeah.
If I'm at the bedside and I ask my patient, are they in pain? If they have PRN ordered pain medication or not, I'll call the doctor if they don't have PRN medication. But if they say that their pain is at an 8 or a 9 or a 10, I'll go get them that pain medication. Even if they're just sitting there, you know, laying in bed with a smile on their face, saying that they're an 8 or a 9 out of 10 pain medication. And I will treat that pain if, you know, it fits the order.
Yeah.
The problem I have is whenever patients start asking for pain medications by name and displaying certain behaviors that are like drug seeking pain medication, like asking for their Ativan or asking for that medication that starts with a D. I can't tell you the last time I gave Dilaudid, because they've kind of almost gotten rid of Dilaudid altogether. That's the pain that... I don't know. They've kind of gone more towards this IV medication called fentanyl, which is a shorter acting opioid pain medication. I know it's a big epidemic out on the streets with fentanyl, but in the ICU setting, it is a fantastic drug because, I mean, it's used as a sedative, but it's short, relatively short acting, and it relieves pain
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not super gorked and sedated for 2 hours, 3 hours after.
Right.
Dilaudid was one of those medications that's always given people kind of a high. People don't care as much about morphine anymore. Dilaudid is kind of, I think, a derivative class of morphine.
Gotcha.
Don't quote me on that, but
we'll just go with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, opioid drug classes are not my strong suit. But anyway, yeah. I try to treat a patient's pain for what it is, but I also try to educate them on the fact that if you are getting this pain medication, it's not going to completely obliterate your pain. You are going to have some pain, especially with the surgical patients. You know, that early mobilization is important, but I'm going to cover you as best I can with this fentanyl or, you know, Norco or Lortab, whatever pain medicine I have for you. And that's basically just going to take the edge off. You're going to have to grind through whatever therapy that you have.
Yeah.
After I give you this medication, and this is just going to help in the very, very short term. You know, you're going to have to get through it, but, you know, I'm here to help.
So do you think to some degree that short term, that statement of it being for the short term gets lost? And they kind of just, upon discharge from the hospital, it's like, what's next? And then there's still pain, so they continue to have pain, and then, like, what do you do?
Yeah, I don't discharge a lot of patients from the ICU straight home. I usually send them to a step-down unit, but I have discharged some patients home, and in the large majority of those patients, they weren't sent home with any kind of pain medicine, and they didn't complain about that. But on some patients that we did send home with pain medication, it was like a 30-day supply or something.
Yeah.
They had like chronic back pain or something like that, so pain for them was kind of a fact of life. So they may not have had the best report on their HCAPs on that specific question about how was your pain managed.
Do you think that skews the scores? Or is that taken into account?
No, I'm sure that skews the scores. Hmm. Especially because they're likely also frequent flyers and repeat offenders, quote unquote. Yeah, they're getting multiple surveys, and if they're given the same answer that's not a 100% yes, that's going to ding those scores.
Yeah.
It's a shame that that question is in a lot of HCAP surveys, because although it's probably included with good intentions, it means something different to different people. Somebody that's not a, you know, chronic back pain or chronic whatever pain individual might have a different answer than somebody who just had abdominal surgery and has no plans on being on Norco for the rest of their life.
Definitely. Yeah.
So that no, I don't think that's taken into consideration at all.
Okay.
But, you know.
What was y'all's education like in nursing on pain? Past, like, the patients.
Patient says what it is, yeah.
Like, what was the, like, did y'all dive into the research on that?
No. I guess that's a deficiency that us as nurses could probably learn more about.
Yeah.
You know, what statistics are there to learn about?
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Because to me,
I don't know what I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah.
Somebody guiding us as nurses on some continuing education on that kind of stuff would probably be beneficial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
pain, like the study of pain and the kind of like how it plays out to me is very fascinating, and that there's a lot of new research and awesome stuff being done on like the processes of it and how perception of pain and its relation to the opioid epidemic has gone over the years, and how just the statement that comes to my mind is like, it seems like a lot of patients are over medicated and under educated on what the pain processes mm-hmm. are.
Yeah.
Whenever I was doing my inpatient work, I working closely with nurses, we would try to time therapy with like their pain dosages and mm-hmm. all that stuff.
Absolutely. But
it seemed like the people that were in the most pain had a lot of pain problems going on prior to their hospitalization. Kind of like you said with the chronic low back pain.
These frequent flyers.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's that they just know what to say,
mm-hmm.
or if indeed there's just some missing link that we can't tap into that's not controlling their pain. I'll always be sensitive to the patient that's in pain.
Right.
But let me say this, like a lot of times we'll be taking care of a patient on the unit and we're working on a busy unit, and you know, you give somebody pain medicine and then 30 minutes later they're asleep, you go in the room and you say, "Hey, how's your pain?" And they go, "Oh, can I have some more pain medicine?" And it's like, dude, I just gave you some pain medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how quickly do you forget? And that's the kind of patient that kind of wears down on a nurse and mm-hmm. makes us scratch our heads, like, what are we really doing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm going with that thought, but that's just an experience that us as nurses go through
regularly.
Yeah, like that's not the reason that I went into nursing. I went into nursing to help people and see positive outcomes and see people go home and return to their normal function. I didn't come to work in the ICU to pass out
pain pills
as like candy.
Yeah,
you want another Pez?
Yeah,
you know, I don't have time for that. I mean, if you indeed have pain, I'm here to help relieve that and help you in any way I can. But
yeah.
I definitely
see there's a difference between an ICU setting for pain and a chronic, whether it be like a very acute situation being in the ICU and that's what brought them there, versus like an acute on chronic, like they've been having pain for a very long time mm-hmm. and then something happened to bring them into the ICU and it's like a very quick acute type thing. And I definitely see that there's a difference in that regard for your setting as, mm-hmm. as a nurse versus dealing with like persistent pain patients in an outpatient setting who are functioning enough to be in daily life at home and not in the hospital.
Yeah.
Versus being in the hospital for whatever reason.
So I don't know if there was a specific question in there. If we were just kind of vamping.
We were vamping. Go ahead.
There was, when you were talking, that reminded me of a couple of patients that I've taken care of where they've had the pain management docs consulted on that patient. And, you know, this was a chronic pain sufferer, frequent flyer, and, you know, the nurse practitioner or the doc, whoever it was with pain management, came by and said, "Hey, we're going to start a lidocaine drip on them." And everybody was like, "What? What is this lidocaine drip?" And the first time I did that was about a year ago when I was working in Roanoke. And
was like, what would cause them to go that route?
So
is that like a step up from all of the other things that we had initially
It's awesome. no, really, it kind of is, because the first time I gave it, the nurse practitioner was breaking it down for me and like how we're going to do this, and like you're going to check their blood pressure every 15 minutes to make sure that they're not tanking and all this other stuff. But really, it's you're loading them up with a certain amount of lidocaine. They get that into their system, and if it's this certain kind of unrelieved pain with all these other medications, mm-hmm. it can be an absolute amazing drug that, you know, you give it as a continuous IV infusion for X number of hours. I'm not giving specifics because I don't remember them off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this lidocaine IV therapy, you know, you get loaded up on it once you're in the ICU setting, and they might be on it for a couple of a day or two, and then they may not. They may go home, and they could be pain free or significantly reduced for like 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks. So that was awesome. I mean, I haven't seen it that much lately, but when I was working on a neurotrauma unit, I saw it a handful of times, mm-hmm. and it's done well.
Yeah,
yeah.
Would you say that seems to be like a what are you pouring over there?
Well, Woofer Reserve.
Woolford.
I think that's how they say it in Virginia. I don't know. Mm. It's not from Virginia.
It's pretty good stuff, huh?
Kentucky straight bourbon.
Would you say that totally that was caught on?
Yeah.
Try that. The reverberations from the table also go through the mic. So
my bad.
Watch that.
Oh, too. That's no good.
Yeah. Would you say that that's a plausible answer for like long term, if it's only 5 to 6, or would you say it's more of like a window?
Because I would say no. I would say that that's probably a great long term solution to pain management relief, because it doesn't have the side effects and the drawbacks that opioid pain medications do.
Okay.
And it doesn't have the addictive properties that opioids do. And the medications that are so abused on the streets now,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can't think of any.
Yeah.
With lidocaine.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. I recognize that it's not for everybody because not everybody's on it, but
right,
not everybody needs to be on it.
Right. So that's kind of like, is that a newer thing that...
newer use, I believe. They've probably only been doing it for... I only saw it starting last year, but I'm sure it's been around for longer than I know.
Uh-huh.
So, but in the grand scope and in the grand scheme of things, relatively new.
Mm-hmm. So, from a physical therapy standpoint, a lot of the common talk nowadays is going from the biomedical model to the biopsychosocial model. So, biomedical meaning historically the healthcare system has looked at what is wrong, say it be low back pain, and you're just treating low back pain. Biopsychosocial model says the patient has low back pain, but it's still a patient. So it's a human
mm-hmm.
with low back pain. You're treating the human, but you're also taking into account all the factors of that human, mm-hmm. the human's feelings, their prior education as to what's going on, how that affects their daily life, all of those different things. The interesting thing with pain nowadays is that in the physical therapy world, you're taking into all those accounts mm-hmm. for that conversation, like whether it be an initial eval, if someone has a lot of pain with certain things. So say we'll just use an example. One of my last evals with home health, it was a patient. They had chronic right knee pain.
Yeah.
And they weren't a candidate for a knee replacement surgery because of other pre-existing factors, other comorbidities, and they were just kind of stuck. And they were independent prior to that, like, progression. They were doing things around the house that they needed to do by themselves. Their spouse had recently passed away a few years ago, so they still liked being independent and going and seeing grandchildren and great-grandchildren, all those life things. Mm-hmm. But they were kind of pushed aside, or they felt like whenever the attending physician that they were consulting for the knee replacement surgery told them that they weren't going to have a knee replacement surgery because they weren't a candidate, that they just lost all hope.
Shut down.
And she said, I felt like I lost all hope. And the thing that we went into was, like, why? What is causing these things? Like, because chronic knee pain, she was told she has bone on bone. There's no more cartilage. Her knee pops. That's a rabbit hole. Crepitus.
Yeah.
And the science of crepitus. There's nothing in the literature that says a joint popping means there's anything wrong going on. It's just a natural fact of life. Shout out to physio tutors. Physio tutors on Instagram and YouTube, probably the guys from Amsterdam that I showed you.
Yeah.
They probably have the best educational video on what a joint popping means. And I show it to patients regularly. Anyway, so we went into all of those factors. I mean, she, whenever I first called her to set up her eval, I was like, how are you doing today? And she's like, well, I'm just getting by. And she mm-hmm. she sounded so, like, defeated. Like, before I was even there.
And it was all centered around her functionality. Yeah.
It was all, like, centered
she
around.
She was told, sorry, we can't do anything for you because we can't replace your knee. And she felt like, well, that's the roadblock. And
that's it. I'm done-skies.
That's a sad misconception with modern medicine. Like, if we can't do surgery, we can't fix it. Done.
Yeah.
Might as well give up.
Yeah. So what we went into is, like, what can you not do? And she had a very, I guess, fear. She had fear of everything. She had fear of standing up out of her chair. She had fear of walking around. Whenever I went to do a strength assessment of her legs, like, putting my hand on her ankle, she was like, mm-hmm. like she jumped. And I was like, what I just did, like, me placing my hand on your ankle to tell you to push against my hand should not reproduce the symptoms of arthritis in your knee. So I was like, whenever that happened, I was like, there is a lot of sensitivity issues that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were taught with the current research with pain is that sensitivity happens over time, and past experiences and prior beliefs can dictate how you as a person feel when something happens in the future. So because her knee had been hurting for so long, just simply touching her ankle to tell her to dorsiflex, to bring her toes up, was hurting her knee. And it shouldn't have been, because there was no other comorbidities that were pointing to that. So we spent a lot of time on education. And I basically, it seemed like what she needed was permission to move. And the main focus of our rehab was, what are things that you can do that don't cause pain to go to an 8 out of 10? Because she was an 8 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then we talked about it. We talked about it. And then she was like, well, based off of like 4 to 6 being moderate and then after 6 being severe, I feel like I'm a little bit more like a 6.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, that's
good. We're already improving.
We're already improving.
Yeah.
And going through those conversations with her and then giving her permission to move and then doing things that kind of opened a window for her to feel better and to not expect her pain to just skyrocket if she stood up, like within one session, decreased her pain. The next session, she was like, you know, William, I think I'm doing better. And I was just like, great.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the right track. Like, because you think you're doing better, we're on the right track. Because yeah. If you think you're doing better, you're doing better.
Because she thought, before you came there, she thought, well, I need this knee surgery. Mm-hmm. I need this complete knee replacement. And, you know, after that one session, you kind of worked with her and told her, like, you know, I'm here to help you regain some of your mobility and improve your life, even though you're not getting what you thought you needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of brought that roadblock down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably what's more necessary now than ever, because everybody's getting their knee replaced and hip replaced.
So kind of like putting out the fires. Like a common phrase in the physical therapy world is thought viruses. Mm. And it always makes me think of, I don't know if you ever, did you ever watch Jimmy Neutron?
No.
No? I guess that was
after my
that
time.
Was after your time. But there's an episode where he goes into someone's head and it's because they have a virus. It's his friend. I can't remember his name. But the virus is just like spreading. Something like that. And I just imagine, like, one word told to a patient can just multiply in their mm-hmm. mind and then tell them.
Or they fixate. Yeah. They fixate on that.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's all relative to that. If we can fix that, everything else will fix itself.
Yeah.
Give me my new knee, then I'll be able to do handstands and cartwheels and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, no.
So I mean, you don't think that's the answer?
Not always.
No.
Nope.
I would probably agree.
Yeah. I've probably known about the psychosocial versus bio.
Biopsychosocial?
Biopsychosocial.
Or biomedical?
Biomedical, that's biomedical. Right. I've probably known about that, but I haven't considered that as much, but I probably should more daily.
Yeah.
I
guess what I was getting to with that question is, I'm always interested to see what other healthcare professions are getting in their like formal education.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I don't have a point of reference.
Yeah.
And I know for a fact in physical therapy, in current education, a lot of my colleagues and peers who are like new grads, some of them don't get that in their schooling, so only some of the PT schools are talking about the biopsychosocial model
mm-hmm.
and its importance. So I guess I'm trying to get a gauge.
Yeah. So if you got a clinical picture of the kind of patient that I'm taking care of most in the ICU, it's a lot of intubated patients who can't talk for themselves
because
they have a breathing tube down their throat. They can't move for themselves because they're laying in a bed, likely with their hands and at least their wrists restrained, so they don't accidentally or on purpose pull out their breathing tube.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of their pain is related to the fact that they are immobile. Mm-hmm. They can't do anything for themselves. They can't reposition. And I've sitting in, on this couch, I've probably repositioned about 15, 20 times.
You have.
You know, so you take that one ability away, and then all of a sudden, that annoying inability to reposition yourself in the bed becomes pain. Yeah. So one thing that we do as nurses is we're turning our patients every 2 hours and things like that to help alleviate that, mostly to prevent pressure ulcers, decubitus ulcers from getting worse and other things like that. But, you know, when a patient complains to us in between those 2 hours when we're turning them, you know, that should be part of our duty, is to help them alleviate that pain by repositioning them, not just slamming them with opioids and other things like that. I think that that's going to lead to more better, more,
more better
to an increased number of positive patient outcomes.
Yeah.
So, you know, just talking to you about that has opened my eyes to something that I can do better as a nurse.
Yeah.
For sure.
So kind of switching gears, what would you say in your mind would either be the best, like the brightest or the worst experience as either a patient of as yourself or with a patient that sticks out into your mind that has really affected you? Because we had, you had kind of mentioned an experience that you had before.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I'm going to be able to articulate it as well as I did previously. However,
I believe in you.
So, I guess it was, what was that? Around April of 2014. Mm-hmm. I had the bright idea to do a double hatch squat cycle. Okay. And I applied it for squats and bench press, strict press.
Okay.
So I was...
And what does a hatch cycle consist of?
It's a 12-week progressive overloading cycle. It's the tits, man. If you've got a weak back squat, this is going to fix that.
And that's the one that you got off the Excel spreadsheet on Google?
Yeah, it was off of, I found it off of Mike Bergner's website.
Gotcha.
Mike's Gym.
So.
Shout out to Mike Berg.
So disclaimer, from the mouth of Matt Bruce, the protege of Gail Hatch.
Right on, yes.
The original gangster of American weightlifting as we know it today. Who Coach Hatch claims that he did like this spy reconnaissance mission with the Russians.
That's badass.
And got their weightlifting plans and then brought it back to America, like the Great Escape. Matt has always said that that program on the internet is not actually the Hatch.
It's not legit.
So it's like.
Well, damn.
It's a faker.
Oh.
So it led you astray, obviously, because
happened? I just did it again. And
oh, did you?
Put on like 20 pounds on my back squat, well, so.
You know.
It's all good.
Progressive overload over time, regardless of what it is.
Shout out to Coach L, who put me on that.
Shout out to Coach L.
Yeah, you're right.
It's just
who
not.
Who is with brute strength.
With brute strength.
So I probably actually got the real hatch squat cycle this past time.
You probably did. Something closer.
Something a little more better.
So but the first time.
Yeah.
Whenever you had what kind of issue did you have? What happened? Whenever
I had some kind of a crazy muscle spasm that probably originated in my neck somewhere. Just ignoring prehab and you know, recovery sessions and stuff like that, because I was doing hatch squat that I found on the internet for squats, front squat and back squat.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I said, well,
bench and shoulder
let's
press.
Do this. So I did bench and shoulder press.
Full body hatch.
Full body hatch. The worst idea I've ever had in my entire life. That's why I have Coachell now.
Experimentation of movement.
Dude, you have to. If you don't expand your mind, then you're destined to stagnate.
Take the blue pill.
That's right.
So what happened?
Dive into the... Well, I guess around week 7. Mm-hmm. It's a wonder that I made it that long. I was on a relatively light back squat. Uh-huh. For, I think it was 225 for a set of 5.
So probably around what percentage of your max? Not something that should have created a danger.
I could have probably done that for a set of 15 to 20 at that time.
So we're in a good percentage.
Right. But, I mean, you also have to consider that you're pretty exhausted. Neuromuscularly taxed.
So the ultimate weightlifter excuses, my CNS was fried. Yes. So your CNS is fried.
CNS is fried. You're in the middle of squat cycle, and I come up from a back squat, and I could swear I heard something pop. Uh-huh. So I dropped the weight and pretty much collapsed. My left arm was numb, and I was feeling pain in my chest. Uh-huh. My girlfriend at the time, now my wife, was at the gym.
Shout out to Liz.
And she saved my life.
Saved your life.
Took me to Baton Rouge General Medical Center, and presented my symptoms. They rushed me, got an EKG done, because, I mean, everything that I was just explaining presented like an MI, like I was having a heart attack.
That stands for
myocardial infarction. Right on.
AKA a heart attack.
No doubt.
So go to the hospital if you experience those symptoms.
Right. Please do. And then, so they hooked me up to the EKG. It's like normal sinus rhythm, 87 beats per minute. Forget about it. They loaded me up with some Loratab 10 and shout out to opioid medications, and gave me an IM dose of Valium muscle relaxer. I was chilling. Felt real good in the ED. Meanwhile,
I feel like that should be a song. Yeah. Feeling good.
So, anyway, I had been in the ED for about an hour and a half. I go back, because I have to go to the bathroom at this point. Mm-hmm. The pre-workout's wearing off, and my cardiac output is pretty lit.
What is it like to have pre-workout and Valium and Loratab in your system all at the same time?
Uppers and downers at the same time? Are you kidding me? I think that's like a junkie's dream. Anyway.
Wait, what kind of pre-workout was it in this year?
It was probably the Progenex Force. Okay. It probably was. I think that was the classic peak of Progenex before they crashed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're still crashing.
They're finding new lows. Anyway. Yeah. That's for another
whole
time.
Whole different topic.
Yeah, they're jumping ship like rats. Anyway, those athletes. Anyway, so I go to the bathroom, and I heard the staff that were ragging on me specifically, thinking that they couldn't hear me, and they were saying like, "Oh, this guy hurt himself doing CrossFit." Of course, the CrossFit. I mean, I was back squatting at the time. I wasn't really doing CrossFit. Yeah. I was, if anything, I was weightlifting.
Yeah.
I was being stupid by applying a program to something that probably should not have been done. But anyway, it wasn't CrossFit that hurt me. It was my own dumb ass. But anyway.
And this is, what kind of staff is this? Is this other
This nurses? Was nurses and a CNA.
So these are your peers.
Pretty much, man.
Because you're a nurse at this point.
They didn't know, but I worked there. I worked upstairs, one floor up, directly above them in the ICU.
Yeah.
And they were hating on me, and I didn't appreciate it. So they were being very judgmental, so I didn't appreciate that. So that kind of does carry over to my own perception of the patient's pain.
Mm-hmm.
Try not to scoff at my own patients. You know? I feel like that's not professional. But anyway, so the doc came in to see me finally, and he was in there for probably 3 or 4 minutes tops.
He got to know you?
He got to know me as far as reading a chart that said that I had shoulder pain.
Oh, that was the medical diagnosis? Shoulder pain?
I'm sure. I didn't read the chart.
I love those.
I'm sure that was it. Probably shoulder pain. No, that's a symptom,
Did you have leg weakness?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't even move my arm.
Okay.
But anyway, he was explaining to me that he also was in the fitness world. He was a triathlete who, you know, trained for marathons and things. But, you know, he told me I just needed to take it easy with the weight. Don't mm-hmm. lift so much heavy weight. And that was kind of an eye roll to me because it was poor advice, yeah. I would say. Long term, I'm not going to lay off the weight. Obviously, at this moment, yeah, I can't move my left damn arm. Yeah. So I won't be picking up the weight. But,
right.
You know, a but year from now, I'm not going to lay off the weight.
A year from now, more yeah. like a week or two.
It was a while.
It was a while?
Yeah, when we went to, where was that, in San Antonio? I was still hurting.
Really?
Yeah. It was weeks and weeks and weeks with working with Brent.
Okay.
Shout out to Underwood Cairo.
Okay. So you were doing your rehab with them.
Mm-hmm.
They
got me right. Yeah. And, but it was a lot more prehab than I'd ever done before. So it opened my eyes to that as an athlete.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to warm your muscles up in the right way. And
right.
I know you hate the word mobilize.
Mobilize? Mobilize is such a... It's such a hot word now.
Yeah, it's a trigger
word. If you put mobility in anything you're selling,
mm-hmm.
it'll sell. The word mobility or functional. If you put that in functional foods.
I saw that.
You saw that?
Functional IG foods.
Story?
Yeah.
Functional foods. It just drew me right in to look at the...
I hope you saved that picture. That's ridiculous.
I think I did. I think
functional foods. What does that mean?
So the thing, from a physical therapy standpoint, that statement of, you know, you just hurt something, you should probably just either totally, basically he told you to totally avoid mm-hmm. heavy weights. Yep. But what if, I mean, you were training.
Yeah. Right?
You were doing a squat cycle and getting ready. So it was shortly after the open.
Yeah.
If it was around regionals.
Yeah.
Where you were judging in San Antonio for the South region.
That's right.
So you're...
Well, it's South Central at that point. We hadn't gone to Super Reach yet.
No Supes Reach.
No Supes Reach. This is OG days, man.
Yeah. So that... So going back to the biopsychosocial.
Right.
You were told... You were basically taken your thing that you did every day, going to the gym, hanging mm-hmm. out with your friends. I mean, we met through the gym.
Right.
We wouldn't know each other if it wasn't for CrossFit.
I met everybody. You know, anybody part of my life now is probably somebody I met through the gym.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I met my wife through the gym.
Yeah.
Forget about it.
You wouldn't be married if it wasn't for the gym right now. So how heavy does that statement weigh on you where it's like, oh, you probably just shouldn't do CrossFit?
You're basically telling me I shouldn't live.
I mean, yeah, to some degree.
Telling me I need to find a new way to live my life?
Yeah.
That's not like, right. No.
It and from a, I guess from a physiological standpoint, like the classic take 2 weeks off of doing anything, from a biopsychosocial point, like the psyche, that person's probably going to get depressed because they don't feel like they can go to the gym for 2 weeks and hang out with their friends. From a bio standpoint, you're taking 2 weeks off of doing any kind of physical activity where they feel like all they can do is, you know, get up, brush their teeth, go to work. Mm-hmm. They're not doing any kind of lifting. What about the fact that, okay, you hurt your shoulder, but what else can you do? Like, there's usually, if you hurt something or you tweak something or you get an injury to something, what other things can you do that doesn't increase pain? Because usually in those acute instances, if there is pain, we probably want to avoid it because there that you need to allow the natural healing process. But if there's other things that you can do that do not increase pain, why the heck would you not do them? Because there's a ever-growing body of evidence for like the hormonal responses of exercise and how that can affect positively healing with other issues. So why would you just say, no, you should just stop. You should just lay off the heavy weights. That drives me nuts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about like on a completely, you know, this is just a slight tangent off of what you were just saying.
I'm about but like, tangents.
Look at the athletes at Wodapalooza. The adaptive divisions that they have. You know, when somebody was an amputee, you know, right leg or right arm amputee, you know, how am I going to deadlift with one arm? That's the question that they have to figure out. And they do. You know, if you were to take similar advice that was given to me, just lay off it, they wouldn't be able to deadlift the 400 pounds or whatever it is that's strapped around their other shoulder.
Yeah.
And lift that off the ground. That's the kind of stuff that if that doesn't get your ass in gear to get your shit right.
Yeah.
I don't know what will.
Yeah.
Those people figure out, you know, what life's all about. So
I think adaptive athletes in that regard are the one of the best examples of the resiliency of the human body and how we've made it as long as we have.
Yeah.
As a species. Sure. And how the body is capable of adapting. I mean, adaptive athlete. I mean, you literally adapt. So it basically boils down to the question of like, what do you want your quality of life to be? Are you going to define yourself by an amputation? Or are you going to define yourself by, I hurt my shoulder? Or are you going to define yourself as, there's this thing going on in my life, but I'm still going to do everything that I want to do. Or do everything that I used to do prior to this to the best of my ability.
Not only are they functioning at a high level and a high capacity,
they're killing it.
But they're competing at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Climbing ropes 15 feet in the air with one arm. I've seen that.
I've seen it.
Would you say that would be hashtag Crayballs mode?
Hashtag littest on earth.
Okay, so DK's his two hashtags that he has created for all of his Instagram posts.
Yeah,
always hashtagging Crayballs mode.
That's right.
That is, if you do anything that is just a slightly above normal,
slightly above average,
you can just hashtag Crayballs mode. You could click on Crayballs mode.
Crayballs mode. Crayballs to the wall. Crayball so hard.
and littest on earth.
Littest on earth.
Littest on earth.
That one hadn't caught on yet. I'm trying to get that one going.
We'll get it trending.
Dex Hopkins said he was going to throw it into the pile. So I saw it like once or twice, but I think it's kind of died out.
Maybe he's just not lit. So, I guess to close, where can the listeners find you if they wanted to, besides clicking on the hashtag on Instagram, Littest on Earth?
They're not going to want to find me because I don't really have a whole lot of lit content, but if they really want to find me, it's at DK Champion of the World on Instagram.
Any other avenues that you go down?
I mean, I'm on Facebook, but ain't nobody checked that anymore.
Okay.
David Kemp. Regular old guy. Hanging with my bros on my profile pic. It ain't nothing.
So, I think that's all we got, man.
Lit, bro.
It was fun.
No doubt. That was stepping outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to wrap this up and we're going to go on a hike tomorrow. Devil's Marble Yard.
Maybe. I don't know how long that is, but it might be worthwhile.
Well, that's all we got. We will be back. We will be back with more content. This was the Alenia Life Podcast with David Kemp, registered nurse, and BSN. Soon to be
NP.
NP.
FNP.
FN, what is the F stand for?
Family Nurse Practitioner.
Family Nurse Practitioner. Coming to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening. Follow us for more content on Instagram and Facebook at The Alenia Collective and our website, thealeniacollective.com. Additional platforms you can download the podcast include iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Player FM, or wherever else you get your podcasts. New episodes dropping weekly.